If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. The guest on today's episode is Vanessa Harding, Professor of London History at Birkbeck University of London, who also wrote a feature for the June issue of BBC History magazine on the Great Plague of 1665. World History's editor Matt Elton spoke to her about how people understood and coped with the pandemic and the lessons it might hold for us today in the midst of the coronavirus crisis.
How familiar were people with the plague before 1665, and why is that year's outbreak known as the Great Plague?
1665 is known to posterity as the Great Plague because of its magnitude. It is the biggest, the most deadly epidemic, apart from the first 14th century eruption of plague into England. So it is the big one. But it's also the Great Plague, or thought of as the Great Plague, because it's the last one. It is the last major epidemic of plague in this country. The last epidemic of plague in this country, and that people looking back tend to see that as being the marker. As for what people know about or knew about plague, they had, I think, a lot of shared history, a lot of shared understanding of what it was, that it has been around for 300 years by 1665. It may not have been very recent. There may not have been a very recent epidemic, but people do have familiarity with the idea. They know there is something called plague. They believe they know how it works and what you have to do about it. So it's quite easy to call on this shared knowledge, this shared understanding to develop practical responses to it.
Is it also because there are more records or more sources available from this particular outbreak?
Yes. This is the one that we can see best, not least, of course, because of Samuel Pepys, whose diary takes us day by day through that. And that Pepys is an amazing read just to see how somebody's responding on that. But we also have other people writing letters or keeping personal memoirs at this time in a way that wasn't the case even 100 years before. And that we have quite a lot of records of government, both national government, the city's government, and parish government, local government, which is where a lot of the actions to deal with plague actually take place.
And how bad was this outbreak and when did it reach its peak?
The outbreak starts in about, or first really visible in about April, and it builds up very, very steeply to its peak in mid-September. There's a week in mid-September when about 7,000 people die, and it doesn't stay at that high level for more than a couple of weeks, and then it begins to tail off again. So that by December, while there are still plague deaths scattered across the city, the epidemic is effectively over.
Did it affect certain geographical areas more than others as well?
It seems to be much worse in the immediate ring of suburbs. So not in the city centre, around St. Paul's and Royal Exchange and so on, but in the parishes a little further out, like Aldgate, like Cripplegate, towards Holborn, somewhere towards the west, like St. Martin in the Fields. Those are areas that are very severely hit, partly because they are densely settled with poor people.
Given that this wasn't the first incidence of this kind of plague, what measures did the government attempt to use to tackle it? And what resources did they draw on from those past examples?
Because plague has been around for quite a long time and there is a lot of exchange of information between local government and central government, and central government is looking at other places, other countries, they have a kind of playbook of what they should do. There's a series of orders or ordinances known as the plague orders or the plague books or directions, and that those are called into play or become part of the action plan once deaths reach a certain level, like sort of 30 or 40 plague deaths a week. And that those cover an enormously wide range of behavioural, environmental, structural things that people should and should not do. In terms of the resources, it's partly the human resources that they draw on things that already exist. So local government plays the largest part in this. Parishes have always been the place where obviously people are buried, so that they are used to counting the dead and reporting the numbers of dead. They're used to burying the dead. But parishes have also been responsible for the distribution of poor relief, for support for people who can't support themselves. And that becomes a major job during the plague epidemic, is that once quarantine is imposed, local governments do their best to support households that are locked up, that can't get out to earn money or to buy food.
So there was already by this point quite a well-oiled infrastructure to try to deal with this kind of thing.
Yes, I think people know what they should be doing, and that a lot of the arguments about what you should do have been rehearsed in the past and discussed more widely. That doesn't mean there aren't tensions between central government, which tends to talk about a more interventionist and controlling set of actions, and local government, which recognises that you can only go so far, you can't coerce, you can only persuade or influence.
Which leads me to my next question, actually, and that's how much did people follow the guidelines that were set out? Was there a lockdown like we have at the moment?
There wasn't a universal lockdown. The way it worked was that once a household or an individual is known to be infected, once there is a report of plague, there is an inspector or a searcher sent, once there is a plague death in a household, and that household is locked up. But it doesn't mean that that other households in the same street will be locked up as well, only when plague cases have been confirmed in particular households. It looks as though that works up to a point, but there is obviously a kind of weariness sets in after a time. And there's quite a lot of resistance to the notion that because one person has plague in a household, the others are all going to be essentially locked up there until they get plague and die. So there are there are well-recorded cases of people breaking quarantine, breaking out of the houses which are supposed to be locked up, escaping out of the back doors or whatever, or even attacking the people who are set to watch the houses. And I think it has to be the case, has to be said that the resources for imposing a forcible quarantine and lockdown simply aren't there. I mean, you know, there's no way in the circumstances that they could impose that, that they could have the manpower or the money to afford it.
Okay, so how much of an understanding of what was happening that we have today did people at the time have of the kind of things they had to do or not do to stop it spreading, or indeed what was happening more generally?
They had a fairly clear understanding or set of beliefs about what it was. And I suppose the first thing to say is that in a time of universal faith, people believed it was a divine visitation of some kind. But that didn't stop them also thinking in practical medical epidemiological terms. So they also speculated about where it came from. And the most common set of beliefs is that it's a kind of miasma, that it's in the air, that it's spread. It's obviously spread from person to person because, or they believe it is spread from person to person, because one of the regulations is about banning assemblies and groups of people meeting together. How it comes about, I mean, whether it's arises from corruption, from foul smells, from whether it's created by the weather or the planets or something like that, there are lots of different theories about that. But it's definitely perceived to be something that is spread in the atmosphere. But it can also, they obviously also think that it, or believe that it can be spread in goods or where people have been. They don't seem too worried about dead bodies, but they are worried about things like the sheets and the bedding and the clothing of people who've died of plague. So you're not allowed to sell those on in the secondhand market. The quarantining of goods may well be to do with this sense that it might be spread once a pack of goods is opened, that the plague might have been trapped in it and might get out. And there are things like saying that hackney carriages, which have taken people who then prove to have plague, mustn't be used again for another week or so. So there is definitely that sense that there's a causative factor that you can catch it under certain circumstances and not under others. But there's also a sense that it's the individual body that may or may not resist it. So the first set of prescriptions about what you might do, not the plague orders, but the ones about health, are that you should try not to catch it. You know, you should be resistant to it. You should avoid places where you might catch it. But you should also, as it were, try to get your body in good order to make sure that it's not susceptible to the ingress of this plague, whatever this plague is.
You mentioned plague orders there. What do we mean by that term?
This is what I call the playbook, a set of rules that are imposed that talk about environmental regulation, that ban assemblies, for example, say that people mustn't gather at whether it's theatres or public houses or things like that. It's about clearing the streets. It's about burning rubbish. It's about stopping animals from wandering in the street. A whole range of things like that.
Going back to the idea of how much people understood, I'm interested in the idea that there's certain jobs. So, for example, we were talking about the searchers and the corpse bearers. Did people volunteer for those jobs at times of plague, or was that just their job? And how did they feel about having those kind of risky occupations? Do we know?
I think we have to say it's the kind of thing you do because you can't afford not to. So, I mean, the searchers are very commonly people who are pensioners of the parish. That's to say, they're receiving support from the parish, and in return, they're asked to do jobs for the parish. Searchers tend to be older women who've often probably had a lot of practice in sick nursing and are therefore good at looking at bodies or sick people to understand what's going on. The corpse bearers also are likely to be poor people who are glad to have that employment. So although individuals may not particularly want to do these things, nevertheless, it is a way of making a living in an epidemic. And when parishes lose them to the plague, as they do, there's usually a number of people ready to take on the post. So it isn't that people won't do these jobs, but they will do them because they have no option, really.
And expanding that point slightly, do we know how people reacted to this outbreak more generally? You mentioned peeps at the start. What records can we use to find out how people responded to this?
It tends to, well, Pepys's diary is the most extraordinary and unique record. Pepys is not at all typical. He's a young, healthy, upwardly mobile individual with quite a confident worldview and a very positive outlook. So he's really not bothered by it for quite a long period of time, and he's quite slow to take actions that might help him or his family. It's not until plague is also geographically very marked, that it starts in one part of London and then spreads to others. So it's not really till the plague gets close to where he lives that he responds and starts to think about moving his family away, decides it's time he makes his will again or makes a new will, those sorts of things. There are letters and correspondence from people who are in London during the plague. There are some other personal writings of various kinds. And there's also information contained within the local records, the parish records or the city's records or the government's records, which may tell you something about people's attitudes and how they're responding. I mean, there very often will be things like petitions for support or help or something like that. So they can give you some sense of the circumstances. But the kind of introspective reflection that maybe we're all doing right now about what does this mean, there's not a lot of that to be found.
People just had to get on with what they were doing, I suppose.
Yeah, as they do now.
And how much was this, for some people, just another outbreak of something they'd experienced before?
I think that there is a kind of, both at government level and at the popular level, there is a kind of folk knowledge of plague. There's a familiarity with it. For most people, the 1665 plague is the first one they've experienced for quite a number of years. The last serious epidemic had been in 1636, when something like 10,000 people died of plague. And the most serious one before that was 1625. So not many people had actually lived through that period. I mean, some had, obviously. But for many people, and particularly since London is a city of migrants, 1665 will be the first major plague they've experienced. Again, there's this kind of folk memory because although there are a number of epidemic years, there are also a number of periods when plague is around and 2,000 or 3,000 people die every year. So between 1636 and about 1648, there is an ongoing phase in which 2,000 to 3,000 people die of plague every year. But that's very localised, so that for lots of people, it's almost as though that wasn't happening. If it stays in the poorer parts of London, then those who are in charge are not particularly bothered by it.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
So there's a tension between historians who look at one kind of evidence, epidemiologists who look at another, and neither of us are terribly good at really understanding the critical difficulties of the other's modes of explanation.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
You mentioned Peeps debating whether to stay or whether to leave. Was there a spate of people just leaving their homes and going elsewhere then?
Yes, quite a lot of people leave London, but they have to be relatively well off and they have to have somewhere to go. So the court leaves London, goes to Oxford. The aristocracy leave London, the gentry, the people who are there, who might see themselves as only part of the time Londoners anyway. Many middling Londoners or upper middling Londoners might have a country house in somewhere like Hackney, which at that time was quite rural. But for middling and poorer people, they really have no option. They have nowhere to go. They're not going to be welcomed anywhere. Indeed, they're going to be strongly resisted by places that fear they may be bringing the plague, as indeed they may be. So that people are supposed to have passports of health before they move. And they also obviously need to have the resources to do so. So one of the reasons so many people stay in London and die in London is that they have no means of making a living anywhere else.
And what scenes might we witness if we were to travel back to London in this time and walk its streets? I mean, what kind of things would we see as a result of this outbreak?
That's a very difficult question. There's a whole genre of plague paintings, which are mostly sort of Victorian dramas of, you know, a child being handed out of a window to somebody else or of the dead carts going around. I think, again, the best thing we can do is to follow those who are writing at the time. And the impression you get from Pepys is that there are quite a lot of people around on the streets, even at the height of the plague. It's emptier than it would be. There is no business going on at the Royal Exchange, for example. But the city's not absolutely deserted. There are not supposed to be burials during the daytime, but by August, the nights are too short to bury all the dead. So there are funerals taking place in daytime. I think one thing that comes out in a number of writers is the ringing of church bells. I mean, London has over 100 parish churches. They're all experiencing some deaths. Some parishes are experiencing several deaths a day or dozens of deaths a day. And if the church bells are ringing even for only a small proportion of those, then there must have been an almost incessant clamour of bells tolling. And that seems to be quite a strong impression that people have, is hearing the bells.
As well as turning to religion and to spirituality, did people try to draw on medical or pseudo-medical cures to help manage the outbreak?
Yes. One of the things that's really striking is there's an enormous outpouring of cheap print, so that people are publishing remedies or advertisements for patent medicines, patent remedies. There's a very popular series of sort of commemorative plague pamphlets or broadsheets, which will commonly combine a dramatic picture, a prayer, some information about previous plagues, and some guidance as to how you might either prevent yourself from getting it or cure it if you had it. So there's a lot of people jump into that field, either because they are printers with print to sell or because they are apothecaries or medical practitioners with cures to sell as well.
And what kind of remedies did people concoct or were encouraged to try?
It's an enormous range. Different people have different views as to what might be good for it. This nonconformist clergyman, John Allen, is absolutely obsessed with a sort of alga that he thinks is going to be can be found. I mean, it's one that sort of grows in the streets after rainfall, and he believes that it's going to be tremendously helpful. I think that's an unusual obsession. The others are all the other remedies are made up of a whole range of things, depending on what your perspective on medicine is, whether you believe in that chemicals and minerals are the right way to go, or whether you have the more traditional Galenic view of the body, which is the four humours, so that you need to rebalance those humours with, if you're too cold, you need something to warm you, if you're too wet, you need something to dry, and so on. So it's really hard to say that there's anything, any common pattern to the plague remedies that you find.
But that interestingly reflects the sort of dueling notions of medicine and how to deal with these kind of things that was present at the time, I suppose.
Yes, yes. There isn't a single thought about what it is or how it should be dealt with. Yes.
Once the outbreak had gone past its peak in September, when did it start kind of reducing, and when did things start going back to normal? Or indeed, was there a new normal afterwards?
The deaths start declining from mid-September, and we have the weekly bills of mortality, which publish the figures of deaths and plague deaths parish by parish every week. And those are a really important source both for us, but they're obviously very popular at the time. So Pepys is always saying how he's read such and such a number for this week. And he reports, thank goodness, you know, the numbers are going down, they're going down again, they're continuing to go down. So that it falls off quite sharply, and by December, the numbers are really quite small. But as I say, you know, there's still probably another couple of thousand plague deaths to come, even by December. The difficulty in knowing about what is the new normal is the fire the following year, which obviously completely upends everything, but it also destroys some of the records that might tell us more about the plague, so that people haven't really picked up the pieces of their lives or their businesses or local government by September 1666. The people who'd left London really seem to start coming back by October or November. That may be a bit early, and because plague is still around. But I think probably most people who would normally spend the winter in London probably have come back by Christmas or January.
Are there any sort of popular modern conceptions of this outbreak or this period that you think we need to rethink?
I think there are two main conceptions or misconceptions that we should think about. Many people have been told or have learned that the fire cleanses London of plague, and that's why there isn't another outbreak. And that can't be true, because if you simply overlaid a map of which parts of London were burnt in 1666 and which parts of London were worst hit by plague in 1665, they simply don't match. It's the city centre that's burnt out in 66. It's the suburbs that are worst hit in 65. So, you know, there's a simple answer to that one. And I suppose the second side of that might be to say that actually, if the city centre is burnt out, that might surely increase overcrowding in the suburbs and make things worse. So I think the reason there isn't another plague is because it's receding from Europe at this time. And it may be that by the time there is another ingress into the European mainland in the 1720s, that quarantine is sufficiently good to prevent it spreading much further. The other thing we have to think about in relation to plague is what the disease is. And there's a long and complicated history to this. For, you know, the first few hundred years, people had all these different ideas about what it was. In the late 19th century, the outbreak of the third pandemic in East Asia seems to have led to the identification of Yersinia pestis as the agent, and of rats and rat fleas as the way in which it was spread. And then over the 20th century, there was a complicated feedback from epidemiological theory about bubonic plague, saying, oh, well, this is how it must have been in the medieval and early modern periods. But there was also reason to say, well, actually, it's not really working quite like the modern plague. Maybe it's not bubonic plague. That argument went on quite fiercely for quite a while. And I would say that it's now got to the point of saying, because archaeology has revealed ancient DNA of Yersinia pestis in burials from plague periods across Europe. So it's definitely Yersinia pestis, but I think there's still a big question mark about rats and fleas and whether that was actually the way in which it was spread, whether that could allow it to spread as rapidly to transmit in the way that it actually did. So there's a tension between historians who look at one kind of evidence, epidemiologists who look at another, and neither of us are terribly good at really understanding the critical difficulties of the other's modes of explanation.
We're obviously talking now in the middle of a pandemic. Can we meaningfully draw parallels or lessons from this period, or is to do so to kind of reduce it to a simple analogy that's not helpful?
It's always difficult to draw lessons from history. I think what I would take from this is how very complex epidemics are, that they're not just about disease. They're about social structures. They're about policies. They're about attitudes, the relationships between different classes or between the governors and the governed. And that the actual outcomes in any particular way are, in any particular situation, are very, very contingent on this whole range of factors that go into them. I suppose the other thing I would say, I mean, reading contemporary writers and so on, is that you do begin to think in terms of what is good behaviour in an epidemic. You know, who is behaving well? We now feel quite strongly about the people who throw their servants out on the street or who abandon the town without leaving any help for those who they left behind. Or indeed about those who refuse to take people in or reject them or whatever. So we do think about what it is to behave in a decent human way in an epidemic.
Are there any sources from the time that particularly stand out for you, or human stories that particularly stand out?
Well, again, I would go back to Pepys. I mean, because Pepys is now accessible, anybody can read him on various websites online. Beyond that, you have to go a bit further, but a good many letters and sources of individuals writing at this time are available if you want to plunge a bit more deeply.
Finally, then, how would you like people to re-understand this particular plague and this particular period, perhaps particularly in light of all that's going on at the moment?
I would like them to reflect on the fact that disease has played an enormous part in human history. We've been enormously lucky in the West, in the global North, for the last half century or so, not having any major epidemics or impact upon us. So I think it pushes us back to a stage in which realizing that life is more dangerous, more uncertain, the future much less predictable than we had become accustomed to thinking.
That was Vanessa Harding. Vanessa wrote a feature about the Great Plague for BBC History magazine. You can read that in our June issue, which is on sale now. That issue also includes a special feature for the magazine's 20th anniversary on 20 of history's greatest mysteries, as well as articles on Europe's last battle of World War II, Thomas Cromwell, and the Crusades. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us next on Sunday for an episode on everything you need to know about the English Reformation.